Hi, folks. Denise Howell here. And next up on This Week in Law, Kyle Coogan joins me, Mike Keyes, and Matt Curtis. We've got TickBox, DragonBox, and RedBox. Oh, my. The Googles from Goo and Two Live Crew. Cars unleashed without drivers in California. And much, much more coming next on This Week in Law.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Law is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is TWiL, This Week in Law with Denise Howell, Mike Keyes, and Matt Curtis. Episode 415, recorded March 2nd, 2018. Disney's Beast Sleeps Tonight. Hello, I'm Denise Howell, and you're joining us for This Week in Law. We're very, very excited that you're here during what is Fair Use Week. We have some great fair use developments to discuss, coincidentally, in honor of that illustrious week, and a wonderful panel of folks to do so with, in addition to lots of other interesting developments at the intersection of law and technology. My co-host, Mike Keyes, is here. Hi, Mike.
Great to be here with you today.
Great to see you again. Mike is a partner at the Dorsey & Whitney firm in Seattle, Washington. The office manager there as well, or the managing partner? How do we style you in that role? Managing partner.
Office managing partner.
Office managing partner. Which is, I'm sure, a lot of thankless work, but a good position to have nonetheless. My other co-host, Matt Curtis, who is a law student at Notre Dame, is going to be joining us shortly. He's a little engaged at the moment, but he should come in at some point during the show. And we have a wonderful guest with us this week. Kyle Coogan is a recent graduate of Duke's Law School, Duke University's Law School, who is in private practice. What city are you in, Kyle?
I'm in New York.
In New York.
Just got sworn in last Thursday, so a newly minted attorney.
Oh, that's so great. Congratulations. We have a huge ESQ we could maybe put down in your lower third.
I'm on it.
Would there help acknowledge said event. That's great. Huge congratulations to you, also good feelings and wishes going out to people who either just took the bar or maybe just taking the bar right now. This is one of the two times of the year when people do that. So we're thinking good thoughts for you all. And Kyle, you wrote in to the show with some great comments about our discussion of the DragonBox dispute, which we'll get into in just a little bit here. You're also writing what sounds like a really fascinating paper, hasn't been published yet, on streaming and esports, correct?
Yeah, that's right. It's kind of a look into the copyright precedent that came out of the arcade games of the 1980s, and looking to see how that might apply to some of the more modern video games. It should be out later this month with the Fordham Intellectual Property Media and Entertainment Law Book 2 later this month.
Oh, that's fantastic. When it comes up, we'll be sure to feature it. Send me the link when it's available. But in the meantime, we do have some great things we can talk about in that arena as well. So in honor of Fair Use Week, we are going to start things out with stories in the realm of Hollywood music and entertainment. So I thought we'd start out with a case that is foundational for the fair use doctrine. It's a Supreme Court case from 1994, throwing it all the way back to 1994, Campbell versus Acuff Rose Music, Inc. And it's one of the first times, and it's still very definitive precedent, that courts have acknowledged that something can be both fair use and commercial. And it acknowledged that when Two Live Crew, again, throwing it way back, if you remember that group, did a cover of Pretty Woman, Roy Orbison's Pretty Woman, and was sued about it, It actually wasn't a cover. I shouldn't describe it that way. The court concluded it was a parody because it, although it used the music and was very identifiable as a Pretty Woman derivation, it changed the lyrics and it's pretty hilarious, actually. So I think we'll just go ahead and play some of that for you so that we have the context of what we're discussing here. Clearly Pretty Woman, right? Okay, this next is my favorite verse. All right, that probably gives you enough flavor. All that hair ain't legit because you look like Cousin Ed. So if you can just throw yourselves back to 1994 and just imagine the Supreme Court having to ponder this case and listen to that song, I'm sure it will put a huge smile on your face. And what they concluded was that this was not infringement, but a parody and fair use. And everyone went on their merry way. So in honor of Fair Use Week, we thought we would acknowledge that wonderful facet of copyright and fair use law. Anything you want to add, Mike?
Well, this is really a watershed case when it comes to fair use. The whole notion of transformative use and what that means in the context of fair use in general. It's a very important case, still very, very relevant. And I, too, every time I read or run into this case, which is quite frequently, I always think about, you know, Justice Rehnquist listening to this song back in chambers or in conference. You know, it's a hilarious thought.
Yes. Yes, it is. And if you're watching our video right now, there is a great video about this song and the Supreme Court's decision on it that was put together by the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill's library. So if you want to learn more about it, learn about the decision and how the court arrived at its transformative use and fair use conclusions, the video that we're playing in the background here is in our discussion points, all of which you can access for this episode of the show at tagpacker.com/user/thisweekinlaw. This is episode 415. So the link to that video and everything else we're going to discuss today is right there for you if you want to go scare it up either during or after your enjoyment of the show here. Kyle, any thoughts? You strike me as a young fellow. You were probably a mere youngster when this case was coming down. This something you studied in school?
It was. And I was just going to say, I think the one quote that comes to mind from that case that was pretty funny from it was basically when they were driving home, the idea that even though it's a commercial use, it won't really have any impact on under the fourth factor. They basically said that it's not really going to displace the quote-unquote white bread original, which is kind of funny because they are pretty disparate songs. The parody is quite different than the original.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. All right. So I thought that was a good sort of frame to our ongoing fair use discussion of more current things happening in the courts. One fascinating development earlier this week was a decision from the Second Circuit in favor of Fox News in the TV Eyes case, which was much watched and I think quite surprising that the court came out the way that it did. So let's talk to you for a moment about what TVEyes is. It may not be a service that you're familiar with, and it is quite expensive. It's to the tune of a $500 a month subscription, and it's basically a way of searching through all of the, as the court characterized it, ocean of video news content out in the world, and finding what you're looking for. So you can imagine how government and law firms and other news organizations might want to be able to sift through all the news coverage in this way, and TVEyes provides that service. Well, Fox News wasn't happy about it and sued, and decided that the fact that TVEyes was recording all of its programming and then making it available in this searchable way was a problem from the copyright standpoint. So they sued, and there was, at the lower court level, a finding of fair use that now the Second Circuit has reversed. And really, I think the best way to think about this case and the way the parties argued this case is, I don't know if it's already starting to sound a little bit like the Google Books cases, but that certainly came up in arguments and briefing on the case. And you know that there, Google prevailed and was found to be able to index and make available its Google Books material without any licensing, without paying any fees, because of the usefulness of that function to the public, and because Google was only making snippets of the copyrighted material available in the search results. Here in the TVEyes case, what TVEyes makes available is up to 10 minutes of video that can then be shared, emailed, et cetera, clipped. What wound up happening here is the Second Circuit decided 10 minutes was quite a bit and distinguished it from the Authors Guild versus HathiTrust and Authors Guild versus Google cases that allow Google Books to exist for that reason. So fascinating case. Fox News will now have some cover and, a way of going forward and saying, hey, you can't use our material. We have this precedent. It may not be the end of the story here. We may see this go up both to a full panel of the Second Circuit for review and possibly up to the Supreme Court. So there's lots to unpack here, Mike. What do you want to add about this decision?
Well, I think you really covered it beautifully. It is a very important case from my perspective. I guess a couple of noteworthy issues regarding the court's fair use analysis. You're exactly right. I mean, the Google Books case featured prominently. Actually, both sides argued extensively that the Google Books case supported their positions. And ultimately, as you noted, really the Second Circuit in this case, in the Fox News case, ultimately determined that making available a 10-minute snippet was just too much. Interestingly enough, from my perspective, we've gotten to the point in a lot of fair use cases where the first factor, whether it is sufficiently transformative, seems to kind of be the predominant factor and drives the decision in a lot of ways. The court found that this use was transformative, but ultimately, I think the amount, the 10-minute amount, the snippets that were made available, coupled most importantly with the commercial use, as you said, there was $500 monthly subscription fee, and a lot of paying for it. I think it just was too much for the court. The significant commercial benefit associated with this use just kind of overpowered the rest of the analysis. Even though, at least as I understand it from reading the decision, it's not like Fox News or any of the other interested parties could point to a pre-existing business model that they that this was cutting into. But it was enough for the court to say, look, there's some a pretty significant financial component associated with this, and you're potentially harming that future market for Fox and others to get into.
Right. TVEyes isn't going to go away, I think, in the wake of this decision. Certainly, they might not go away in the courts. As I mentioned before, they may continue to push forward and say, you know, urge fair use arguments that have been rejected now by the Second Circuit.
Yeah.
They might, you know, well be able to find a way to keep functioning within the parameters of what the Second Circuit has said. They may be able to continue to offer video search functions that just
right.
have less extensive use of the material and sharing of the material and that kind of thing. Kyle, any thoughts?
Yeah, I missed but yeah, I think important to the decision is the fact that the search function was separated out and that issue was the watch function. I think it's a little difficult to separate those two completely when you are doing this analysis, because there was a lot of discussion when they were talking in the first factor about how transformative or not the watch function was. And the dissent actually criticizes that as dicta. He didn't think they needed to go into that. But when they talk about that, they talk about the kind of the efficiencies of presenting this video material, which kind of seems inherently tied to the search function. So it's a little thorny there. And to your point, you know, there is some room for TVEyes to go forward and still have a product that doesn't infringe under this opinion. But then also just a comment on, I thought the crux of the fair use analysis was thorough and interesting. They kind of bookended it though with some language where it was where they basically say that it's not fair because it deprives Fox of revenue that properly belongs to the copyright holder, which just kind of seems circular. To shamelessly quote Holmes from Inus versus AP, property, a creature of law, does not arise from value, a matter of fact. And so it's unclear to what extent, to your point, you know, if they are able to create a lesser version of the watch function that is not infringing, you know, at what point is it a predictable market that Fox should be entitled to get into through licensing revenues? And it's just a hard mm-hmm. hard analysis. So you can't just summarily say that this is something that is entitled to licensing revenues. But yeah, very interesting case.
Yeah, I mean, I have the feeling that TVEyes is a much used, probably very profitable service that doesn't want to have to go to its users and say, hey, we're really going to have to change what we're offering you because of this pesky court decision. And obviously Fox News is just one of the outlets that they include. So I have the feeling there will be some grand negotiating going on here to figure out a way that they can maintain their service and pay the rights owners what they think they are owed to be included here. So look for that to happen too. Mike, any final thoughts?
No, I think we've covered the waterfront.
All right. Let's move on to one of your colleagues, Mike, who has a great blog post pointing out that things change a bit from the copyright licensing standpoint with the Olympics this year. Charlene Crow wrote a piece at your firm's the TMCA.com blog and pointed out that this is the first time, the Olympics that we just had in Pyeongchang, where singles and pairs ice skaters were allowed to compete to music with lyrics. I think much to all of our delight watching the Olympics recently. We had, Ed Sheeran, Beyonce, Coldplay, many other popular performers featured as the skaters were skating. But as Charlene points out in several paragraphs, the licensing on that is all convoluted and terrible. And there might be some ways forward for NBC that would involve, okay, maybe you could use some of these works during a live performance, but not if you're going to do a recap. And by the way, a lot of their broadcasting was not live, right? If you're going to do tape delays or recapitulations or best ofs, then a whole different copyright licensing strategy might be needed. And it differs whether it's the sound recording or the the other
like
thing.
The underlying like, sheet, like the sheet music.
Yes, yes. The composition, right? The copyright in the composition. So I love that she weighed into this and tried to make sense of it, but then she just kind of comes out and says, and I think she's taking a cue from you, Mike. In the end, NBC certainly trained for this event and had its gold medal team working to ensure the right licenses are in place for the broadcast of the Olympics. And I think what she means is in the end, they probably just licensed everything and didn't rely on possible gray areas of the law, don't you think?
I would imagine that's exactly the case. Yeah, it's a great post, a great reminder about the complexities associated with any sort of musical composition. You know, you've got multiple rights, typically owned by multiple parties, that need to be cleared before you can use a piece of music. So it is can be a fiendishly complex situation.
Absolutely. Kyle, any thoughts about figure skating, licensing, or anything related?
I mean, it was a really interesting blog post. I would be interested to see how even more intractable and confusing that gets, given that it's the Olympics and, you know, there's worldwide broadcasts and you're going to have different laws in different jurisdictions. So it's just the dual copyrights that you get with it.
You're absolutely right that NBC is not the only media outlet who needs to worry about licensing the music used in these performances. And some might care less than NBC about whether they've crossed all the T's and dotted all the I's. Let's jump into a discussion of what you originally wrote to me about, Kyle, which was the Dragon Box case we discussed several episodes ago, which is an over-the-top piece of hardware that, you know, we kind of speculated on the show about how it might or must work, but it seems to be finding unauthorized streams of television programming, movies, etc., and making it available to consumers, saying things like, why would you want to pay for expensive cable or satellite when you could use our device? And it's not the only box out there that is in the entertainment industry's crosshairs. There was also a case filed against a company called TikBox, which from what I can tell, again, without looking in great depth under the hood at how these things work, is pretty similar to DragonBox. And TikBox had an adverse result. When was this? End of January. As an injunction was issued that will enable the company from continuing to operate as it has been. The industry actually asked for the injunction to be even broader. They wanted TikBox to have to go and impound all of the devices it had sold. The court said, no, you don't have to do that. But if you have things that are making your devices capable of infringement, you're going to have to disable that functionality. So when you wrote to me about DragonBox, you thought, Kyle, that maybe there was an argument that these companies aren't considering. Can you flesh that out for us?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think at first blush, it seems to be pretty clearly a pretty clear argument under Napster and Grokster that these things like TikBox or DragonBox are kind of behaving in a similar manner as the peer-to-peer clients were back in the day. But you know, with the move to consuming media through streaming, and I'm pretty sure I looked up TikTok's, you know, in view of that article, and I looked into Dragon Box a little more, and it does seem to be mostly streams, either streams of live streams of TV or streams of like streams on the consumer end of video on demand that's being hosted, like a movie. And the reason that's interesting is because Grokster and Napster was a, you know, secondary copyright liability. And for secondary copyright liability to attach, you have to have some direct liability underpinning. And with Grokster and Napster, you know, that was pretty clear that there were unauthorized duplicate copies being transferred between the peer-to-peer networks. But here, the end users are merely consuming the stream, and it's in a fleeting buffer. And that's interesting because there's the Ninth Circuit case, MAI versus Peak, which stands for the proposition that if you load software into RAM and it exists in the RAM ad infinitum, that's sufficiently fixed enough to be a directly infringing copy. But interestingly, there's a case, Cartoon Networks versus CSC Holdings out of the Second Circuit, which there's a lot of interesting stuff going on in that case, but a key part of it focused on DirecTV having on its servers, basically routing end user TV traffic through its servers, and it focused on the buffers in those servers of that end user TV traffic. And there is buffers of maybe 0.1 to 1.2 seconds. And the Second Circuit found that that was too fleeting to be considered a directly infringing copy. So that means under, like, under that, what the argument is, the end user viewing these streams illicitly, there might not be as strong of an argument, because if the Central District of California works, then they could view those streams as too fleeting to be directly infringing, and you'd have to look elsewhere, perhaps through like a public performance theory. Or it'd be interesting because if they went the way of MAI versus Peak and it went up to the Ninth Circuit, then you could have a circuit split on the issue of buffer and buffering and whether or not they're sufficiently fixed to be infringing copies.
Yeah, I think those are all really good points. TikBox is trying to make the argument, and I'm sure Dragonbox will also urge something similar, that they're not responsible for their users' infringement, that these things function like a computer and whatever the users choose to do with them is up to the users, and that they should be protected. Judge Michael Fitzgerald is hearing both these cases at the trial court level. The Dragonbox one hasn't had a hearing on an injunction yet, but if this TikBox decision is any indicator, we know how the judge is leaning, but we also know that the judge is subject to review and that this may not be the end of the story. So I think that's a really interesting point that you raise, Kyle. Mike, what do you think?
I do. I think it's interesting, but Kyle, wouldn't the argument still be that, at least with respect to some of the examples in the opinion, I think they were like theatrical releases that still weren't available elsewhere, that you could go out and find streams of those. The copies that would be residing on the server that you're accessing, I mean, that wouldn't be authorized. And so wouldn't that be an illicit or unauthorized copy, such that the whole Grokster analysis would apply?
So, yeah, without a doubt, the original uploaders of the video on demand, like the unreleased movies or even the live streams of TV under Aereo, those are infringing both because it's unauthorized duplication in the movie context, or because they're publicly performing to, you know, people who have access to those websites over the internet. But what would be interesting would be to see courts kind of tackle the analysis of that secondary liability as to that public performance of those works to the end users. So yeah, you could definitely go after the people who host those streams or upload that content. But then there's this middleman that doesn't necessarily need to be there for that content to be accessed. So to what extent are they materially contributing to that public performance? And it's interesting because, you know, there was some discussion in Aereo where the dissent, Scalia dissent, said that, you know, the people who are publicly performing are the end users clicking play. That was, you know, the majority said that it's the area who's broadcasting it out. But it would be interesting to see, you know, if you have these devices in the different homes, like, yeah, I guess to what extent can that activity be aggregated such that, you know, those are enabling the public performance?
Yeah.
I don't think it's definitely an uphill battle for TikTok and DragonBox for sure. But I think nonetheless, it'd be interesting to see the opinions that would come from that if this did go to trial.
Yeah, I think it's going to be really interesting to watch because I do think that they have some solid legal arguments to make, but that those solid legal arguments will get lost around the fact that, you know, they're marketing themselves as this alternative to paying as much for the kind of material you can access with the device. I just remember in the Napster and Grokster cases, the marketing and what people were being told was such an influence on the courts, considering what they were looking at there. And I think that they do have something legitimate to talk about in what you're talking about, Kyle, that you know, hey, we're not hosting this infringing material, go after the infringers. We know that we've been talking in recent weeks about the Boing Boing case where they had a link on their blog to infringing material. And of course, we would all say it's fine to link to something that's infringing. And that's kind of what they're doing here.
Right. Go ahead, Denise. Finish.
I was just going to say, I think a court might have a hard time reconciling that this was a legitimate business model that jibes with our existing copyright laws, even though I think they have some solid arguments to make. What were you going to say, Mike?
Yeah. So, I mean, I guess to kind of slightly reframe what the argument would be, you know, Grokster relied heavily on this whole notion of inducement, that if you knowingly build your business model around people that you know are going to infringe the copyright, then that's going to be a problem under the Copyright Act. But I think, Kyle, the argument you're seeing is that, look, there's no inducement in that sense here because the content is already up there and residing on a server somewhere. So you're not inducing, you know, TikTok and DragonBox didn't induce that original act of infringement. This is kind of one step removed from that. So I think it's an interesting novel theory.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it would be interesting. The flip side of that, of course, and that the publisher is disseminating these devices increases the traffic to those illicit streams, and to the extent that that increase in potential audience would drive others to maybe enter into that illicit business model of uploading these streams, and that is inducement. So there's the flip side, too, which is why I think it's definitely an uphill battle. But it would be it wouldn't just be you know, TikTok loses C. Grokster. It would invite some interesting opinions.
I like the most concise legal opinion ever. all right. Speaking of boxes, this was surprising. The other box we've been discussing on the show recently is Redbox and its dispute with Disney. You remember we told you about this very clever thing that Redbox did. It wanted to expand its business model. It wanted to deliver its customers something more than just the hard copy DVD or Blu-ray disc, because, you know, we're living in 2018 and people want to watch things that they can download or stream. And so what Redbox went out and did was buy a bunch of Disney combo packs, which include the Blu-ray disc, a DVD, and a movie download code, which could be redeemed. All you had to do was go to a certain site and enter the code. Disney said, no. You know, we've wrapped all our packaging around this stuff in restrictions that say these download codes are just for the people who are buying for their own personal use these Blu-ray and DVDs that they come bundled with. And Redbox, you may not do this. So this case, it has been pending. That's why we brought it up. And Disney moved for a preliminary injunction, much like the one we were talking about against Tickbox, where the where Redbox would be prevented from going forward with this business model based on the fact that Disney was highly likely to succeed on its copyright claims. And not only did the court deny the injunction, but it went even further and decided that in making these arguments, Disney is committing copyright misuse, that it is shutting down a competitive area of the market. It's overreaching the extent of its copyrights in a way that's prohibited by the Copyright Act. And if this goes forward and Redbox jumps on it and capitalizes it, this could be very, very bad news for Disney. So among the other things that could happen, if we continue going down this road and Redbox prevails on this theory that the court has thrown to it, is that Disney could lose the right to enforce movie copyrights while illegally purporting to prohibit resale or rental copies of those works. So this is an incredibly interesting development. I'm sure one that Disney was not anticipating when it filed this lawsuit and moved for the injunction. That's one of the interesting things that can happen to you when you get in court. You do not know what judges and juries are going to do with your claims. And I'm sure this one took Disney by surprise. The judge here is U.S. District Judge Dean Pregerson, who made these rulings this week, I believe it was, yes, or last week. Mike, you must have all kinds of thoughts about this.
Yeah, I was stunned by this decision. Mm-hmm. But for a number of reasons. So the whole notion of copyright misuse, I mean, my understanding of that doctrine and where it comes from is when you use your market power to kind of parlay your copyrights into something, you know, far beyond what you're entitled to enforce under the copyright statute. It comes into play. It's an anti-competitive type of issue that arises when it comes to patent and copyright misuse. Not something that's successfully litigated, at least in my experience, all that often. There's not a ton of cases out there on copyright misuse, and a lot of courts have rejected arguments based on this. So as I understand the misuse argument here, it's what the court is saying is those digital codes that are provided, you're trying to restrict a consumer from capitalizing on the digital stream and making sure that they still own the physical copy of the movie that they purchased. And because you're trying to tie those two concepts together contractually, I guess, that is the copyright misuse. So you're essentially bundling the digital code along with the copy of the movie and making sure that consumers have both before they can stream the film. I just don't buy it that it's misuse. To me, it seems like you could make the argument that, look, I'm just trying to protect. I have no legal requirement to provide a digital copy of this, but to the extent mm-hmm. I'm going to, I want to make sure that this code isn't indiscriminately distributed to everybody so that they can get a copy of the or get a stream of this particular movie. So I think it's from my perspective, I think it's a rather concerning decision. I would imagine that it's going to be appealed and dealt with by the Ninth Circuit. I would think so. I don't know. I'm a little bit troubled by it, frankly.
Yeah, it seems a little bit, I have not read through the entire order yet, and I want to do that. But aside from the fact that the judge brought in this copyright misuse concept, a lot of people thought that this case would involve the first sale doctrine. And that's not exactly where the court went with this, sort of skirted by the first sale doctrine. And didn't hang his hat on it. So I think there's a lot to talk about on the legal front there. There might be a lot for the Ninth Circuit to unpack. I'm sure Disney's lawyers are trying to throw everything at this because it would be, you know, a bad thing to let stand for them. Kyle, what do you think?
So from not really a legal perspective, but just generally, I think to the extent that this will disincentivize Disney from bundling these things, it's unfortunate because personally I prefer to rent from iTunes because I'm not going to spend $19.99 on a digital file that doesn't come with a DVD. But at the same time, like in today's day and age, I'm not going to just buy a DVD without the digital file. So it has interesting practical implications on that pretty useful sales practice.
Yeah, absolutely. Certainly Disney must be thinking about how perhaps it doesn't want to go that route anymore. But the reason that this copyright misuse concept was seized upon by the court is because it was looking forward or looking ahead to when to Disney wanting to lock up the market for digital downloads of its works. And I think that the court here thought that that was overreaching. Mike, I'm sure the studios would just say, well, of course there are works. We're going to have those markets. We have the rights to distribute them how we'd like, whether it's on a physical DVD or Blu-ray or in digital format. And as we were just discussing in this Tick Box and Dragon Box concept, as opposed to the Red Box context, if other people are distributing those works, we have something legally to say about that. Right, Mike?
Yes. I mean, I think that's, if I understand your point, Denise, I think that's right. That, you know, this isn't something to me where it's a classic case of misuse where you're providing a piece of IP on the condition that somebody purchases something else from you. Mm-hmm. You know, where you're trying to use that market power increase revenue to you in a way that wasn't contemplated by the Copyright Act. I mean, to me, it's like, look, I don't have an obligation to provide a digital stream of this, but to the extent I do, I still want to be able to control that because I don't want everybody being able to share and stream a film. If you purchase the hard copy, you're entitled to a digital stream along with the code, and I should be allowed as a copyright owner to enforce that. So, again, I'm a little bit disturbed by the decision.
Yeah, I definitely think it will be interesting to watch and see what other courts may make of the legal issues in play here, including the first sale doctrine. And I believe when we initially talked about this, we talked about how it's hard to see how you would have a copyright in the actual code that's being distributed. But the fact that the code unlocks your copyrighted works has meaning as well. So one to watch and definitely a dramatic turn in that dispute that I don't think that Disney saw coming anywhere or anyhow. All right, Kyle, let's move on. You also are working, as we mentioned at the top of the show, on a scholarly paper on the issue of streaming and esports and I'm not sure if gaming is involved in that too, but we've talked before on the show about the, I was going to say strange area of the law about Let's Play videos and how, you know, the law does not really contemplate or accommodate this burgeoning economy of YouTubers and others, Twitchers, who are doing Let's Play videos and making tons of money at it. Clearly, there are all kinds of legal considerations there, and I assume that that's at least partially what you're getting into in your paper. Can you describe it for us?
Yeah. So, as you mentioned, I mean, there's this burgeoning field of all these different ways to consume video games that are not through playing them. I mean, esports is blowing up. I think the video on demand and streaming market, the most recent figures that I plugged into my paper, I think it's surpassed $4 billion now. So it's ripe for contention now that there's more money on both sides of it. And so the idea behind the paper is that some of the legal precedent that was created in the 1980s rests upon just that kind of antiquated technology of video games. But it's still on the books and it's still good law. And so what happens is you have people issuing DMCA takedowns for their video games, and they're otherwise valid until, you know, litigated, because what came out of the 1980s is that you have a copyright not just in the software that drives video games, so that's the literal aspect as a literary work, but also in the audio-visual work, so all of the sights and sounds that the video game is capable of being produced, the publishers have a copyright in that. Mm-hmm. And so the paper, it's not really so much of a normative discussion of how things ought to be one way or the other, but just kind of an analysis of the language and the facts and the case law that came out of the 80s and how those analyses might play out given today's video games. There's a lot of different things that that kind of obfuscate the analysis. For one, back then, the authorship discussion was more straightforward. There's this argument that because players interact with the games, then the publishers don't have the requisite expression on the output of the video game to be an author of those audio visuals. So that's one argument that would be looked at differently nowadays, given how complex video games are. Another argument is games as systems. That was discussed back in the 80s, to be discussed now too, because to the extent that video games are just state machines, you know, today in 2018, they're even more elaborate state machines. So that invites a discussion. And then lastly, one of the discussions in my paper talks about the fixation analysis, whereas before, when people brought up the fixation, they were arguing that these audio visuals aren't sufficiently fixed to qualify as a copyrighted work. But the course basically says, well, no, like everything is there. It's on the printed circuit board. Everything to produce these audio visuals is there, so they're sufficiently fixed. But nowadays, you know, with online gaming, you have bits on servers. You have, you know, people scattered around the world. The information to produce the audio visuals and the real time dynamic elements of the video game are all over the place. So that's another argument. All of those arguments kind of just invite discussion to what extent these audiovisuals are still copyrightable at the outset as they were in the 1980s. And it's very possible that we could see that get revisited.
Yeah, that's really fascinating. And I'm trying to think through esports adding a layer to the Let's Play analysis that isn't there if you're just playing the game and commentating on it, or watching someone play the game and commentate. Sorry. Oh, I thought you said something. In any event, when you're, you know, if you're getting into the sports realm and analogizing to other kinds of spectator sports, clearly baseball games, football games, et cetera, are among the most strongly, zealously guarded, copyrighted material that there is out there. And you can't really envision a world in which someone would be able to watch a major sporting event and show it live or even after the fact. Well, I don't know why anyone would want to watch it after the fact. Having it be live is sort of part and parcel of the experience. But then, you know, overlay their commentary on it and say, this is fair use and I'm solidly on a strong exception to copyright infringement. We don't see that happening. So I can't really see that esports would be all that different of an analysis, or do you think they might be, Kyle?
Well, it's interesting that you mentioned that. So when you talk about the sports and those audiovisual works, there's the creative element of the camera angles and all of that that entitled them to copyright protection. But importantly, I mean, the underlying, you know, so-and-so ran for 10 yards, you know, so-and-so passed, you know, 20 for 24, those are not copyrightable. And so in a similar way, I think the esports industry and the Let's Play creators, those downstream users would argue that, you know, the underlying audio visuals of the real-time esports might not necessarily be entitled to copyright protection. And to kind of see that example through, you could see where an esports competition would be entitled to copyright protection for how they're presenting everything with, you know, if it weren't for all of the audio visuals and the underlying video games being copyrighted at the outset. So I think, yeah, it's an interesting analogy, but it comes down to what extent there is copyright protection over the full possible permutations of audio visuals that a video game can produce just at the outset of the video game being published.
Got it. Well, we'll look forward to your paper. Mike, do you have any questions?
I think it's a real fascinating issue. You know, as I understand it, Kyle, I mean, we're dealing with copyright issues, as you say, back in the 80s, like the Duke Nukem case, I think, is one of them out of the Ninth Circuit that I think dealt with this issue about explaining why the game publisher has copyright protection in the audiovisual display that results. I mean, 20 years ago, these games were you know, very simplistic by today's standards. So I think it's an interesting, you know, we're on the bleeding edge here of copyright claims, it seems to me. Interesting stuff.
Yes.
Yeah, and I think especially it'll be interesting because there's such a wide variety of types of games. You know, at the one end of the spectrum, you have these like digital collectible card games like Hearthstone, which are basically tabletop card games that are implemented on an iPad or a laptop. And at the other end of the spectrum, you have games like Minecraft, which they tout as a game for you to go into and create anything that you can imagine. And then in the middle, you have kind of real-time strategy games where it's a little more confined and it's player versus player, player versus environment, way more of an edge case. And so, yeah, not just the fact that technology has advanced to the point where maybe the 1980s precedent needs to be revisited, but also the precedent that gets created will be different for different genres of video games just because the technology is such that we have so many different things out there.
Hey, Matt Curtis has joined us. Hi, Matt.
Hi, sorry to be late. Things just got kind of crazy on my end, and glad to jump in and hear about this interesting area of the law.
Yeah, it's good to have you. You'll remember, and I'm sure that folks who listen week in and week out to the show will remember that we've discussed a case that involves photorealistic computer graphically generated characters. So think of Drax the Destroyer. Think of the Beast in Beauty and the Beast. Various other films. I'm sure there are, you know, a slew of them you could think of where a complete character in the film is a, in large part, a digital creation, but is also in some ways acted out. There's a lawsuit that was pending. Parts of it still are pending, but the copyright part of it has been dismissed by a company. The company who is the plaintiff is called Reardon LLC. And through a number of other legal disputes and proceedings that aren't really relevant here, Reardon LLC became the rights holder of something called the MOVA Contour Program, which captures 3D shapes and motions of the human face to sub-millimeter precision. It owns this technology and was essentially urging a case against Disney, Fox, and Paramount that when they've created these extremely realistic digital characters using this technology, they have done so without properly compensating the technology holder for the enormous profits that these characters have generated. The analogy here that has been urged is it's like if you are a Photoshop or Word user and you use it to write your great novel, and Adobe or Microsoft comes to you and says, hey, pay up. So that part of this case by Reardon LLC has been dismissed. They are not going to be able to hold the studios accountable for thinking that Reardon owns the copyright to the output of the use of this technology. Other parts of the case are going to continue. There are trademark claims and inducing patent infringement claims that will survive this particular determination by the court. Mike, what do you think of this?
Very interesting decision. Procedurally, you know, it's very much still in the nascent stages of the case. This was on a motion to dismiss, and Judge Tiger did dismiss the copyright claim, but notably dismissed it without prejudice. So presumably, the plaintiff could come back and take another run at it. Essentially, as I understand Judge Tiger's analysis, he's saying, look, the lion's share of the output wasn't created by the program. The individual actors and the directors were, you know, substantially involved or responsible for the creative output that occurred. Now, it's possible for the plaintiff to go back in and make additional allegations explaining why the lion's share of the output was created by the program as opposed to the individual actors or directors. So I'd say stay tuned. We're not out of the woods on this one yet, or the studios aren't out of the woods.
The lion's share or the beast's share?
Good question.
Matt, any thoughts?
Yeah, it seems like a surprising legal argument to bring in terms that, this does seem similar to using Adobe or using, the web interface for Skype for this call, that, you know, the most creative elements are being done with the creation of them. And all technologies kind of go back to that, you know, when you're using a photograph, yeah, you couldn't do it, but for the camera, but you don't, the maker of the camera doesn't get that. So, also it seems like this would have been handled on a contract basis. If they put this, Disney's not going to use, an Adobe type platform. If the copyright that, comes out of that is going to be owned by, Adobe. So, I just thought it was, a stretch of an argument.
Yep, me too. What do you think, Kyle?
I think just real generally, this case is like it should be a law school exam fact pattern between the economic espionage and secondary liability for patent infringement and then copyright and software outputs and trademarks. It has everything.
It does.
I think, yeah, this software output issue is interesting. It seems that there's basically, when you're talking about the lion's share of the lifting, there's an authorship originality argument. And then just to tie it back to kind of the video game discussion, it's interesting because on the one hand, you know, this 3D rendering technology and like the argument that it's, you know, similar to Photoshop, like there's no question that the people using those are adding enough expressive elements to own a copyright in the output. And it'd be, you know, to tie it back to the video games, it's interesting if you have a game like Minecraft where you're showing a Let's Play of this Minecraft city that you're creating and using, you know, a lot of your creativity and expression to build this, to what extent should the Minecraft publisher be able to issue a DMCA takedown of your channel that you're displaying this output of essentially the Minecraft software? So it's it kind of, yeah, it kind of comes full circle back to the video game discussion. It's an interesting case, though.
It is. Let's make lion or beast our first MCLE passphrase for this episode of This Week in Law. We put these phrases in case you are watching or listening to the show for continuing education credit, either in the legal field or some other field. We put these phrases in case you need to demonstrate that you actually watched or listened to the show. So write it down. We'll put another one in the show before we wrap things up today. And if you are a lawyer in the United States, if you head on over to wiki.twit.tv, find our This Week in Law page there, we have a little chart up that should help you figure out how to apply for credit in your jurisdiction or whether that's even possible. So we'll, as I said, we'll put another one of these phrases into the show before we wrap things up. And what is about to wrap up before too long here, in a matter of a couple of months perhaps, is the case that we've discussed on the show several times in the past involving Microsoft's storage of customer data in Ireland, which has big privacy ramifications. So let's talk about that next. So this case was just argued before the U.S. Supreme Court this last Tuesday, and it is a dispute where the federal government was involved in some sort of drug trafficking case, wanted information about the suspect from Microsoft. Microsoft demurred, saying, no, that information is stored overseas, physically on servers that we maintain in Ireland. So we can't give it up to you. We don't control it for purposes of what's called the Stored Communications Act in a way that we could hand it over to you. And Microsoft has been through the trial court and the Second Circuit, which we've already discussed today on the show. The Second Circuit found for Microsoft here. And then the federal government asked the Supreme Court to weigh in, which it will likely do, even though it's hoping that Congress will also address the issue. Justices Ginsburg and Sotomayor both said at oral argument this week that the proposed Senate bill called the Clarifying Lawful Overseas Use of Data or Cloud Act, they're so clever, would address the issues in this case. It says that an order issued under the Stored Communications Act, if this bill passes, it would specify that a court order issued would apply to all data a provider possesses, manages, or controls, regardless of where it is stored. So this is potentially coming down the pipe. And in fact, interestingly enough, just as a sidebar to the oral argument, Orrin Hatch attended the oral argument. Senator Orrin Hatch from Utah sat in the front row and, attempted, you know, seemed to be signaling to the court that, you know, we got this. we're on this issue. But whether the court agrees or not, you know, the court probably won't just say, oh, Congress is going to act here, so we don't have to decide this case. I think the court is likely to weigh in. So just an update that that case has been argued before the Supreme Court. There were some indications in the argument that Microsoft was playing it a little cute by saying that it didn't actually have access to or control over this information simply because the servers were in Ireland. And there did seem to be some concern by the court that that a market might exist for people who wanted to be sure that their data would not be turned over to law enforcement under any circumstances, and that by simply storing things overseas, that could be the gateway to such a service. And I think that the court thought that that would be a bad policy move. So we don't know. The court hasn't ruled yet, but these arguments did play out this week. Matt, any thoughts?
Yeah, so I listened to the arguments, and I also listened to there's another podcast, First Mondays, which had the general counsel of Microsoft on it, and it seemed that if this did go through in the Cloud Act, which is very cutely named, would go through, that Microsoft would push to have the case I'm not sure dismissed, or I'm not sure what the Supreme Court method is, but they. And if they push for that, it seems like that would be clarified without the Supreme Court's decision. But it was just amazing to me how little the arguments actually dealt with the statute. It all dealt with the marketplace for hiding data overseas, and you know, the externalities involved with this and the data privacy. But it didn't really go too far into depth, or at least didn't stay on the statute itself. Which seems to be the actual issue. This does seem like a cute case that Microsoft decided to litigate this prior to, you know, they knew this issue would come up, and this was after, you know, it seemed to that the Snowden issue played a big part in their building awareness that as a company they need to be on the side of consumers, which is all good. And this is sort of an edge case that they got to show that. So I think that there's very little ramifications about day-to-day life or anyone's privacy for this case, because the exact protocols of their cloud are unclear, but it has to do with if a person signs up and they indicate that they are from another country. So you can indicate that you're from Ireland or from the EU or something like that. That's where your data is going to be primarily stored. But if you're in the United States, most data protocols will keep it also in the United States. So in the instance that you were in the United States, even a foreigner, they would still get your data, or even if you communicated with a United States company, which a lot of people do. So, it'd be nice for Congress to handle this. It seems like they put in procedures in the Cloud Act to allow people to step up and other countries to step up and say, we don't want your data. And that's really about setting precedent so that other countries aren't stealing the U.S.'s data. So I think that's really interesting. I think the case is a lot of PR.
Okay, Mike, any thoughts?
Boy, I don't think so. I think we've kind of covered the big issues. It's going to be interesting to see. We should know by summer what the result is here.
That's right. I think that's accurate. Kyle, anything you want to add?
I agree. I think you guys just about covered it.
All right. Let's move on to an issue I put in just for you, Mike, that has to do with trademarks. There is one really surprising aspect to this dispute, which I'll mention in a moment here. What's not too surprising is that a company who wrote a book, or an entity, people who wrote a book called the Googles from Goo back in the 90s, wound up in a dispute in the early 2000s with Google, arising out of the similarity of the name. The identical nature of the name of the Googles from Goo, and of course the mega company Google, now Alphabet, but of course Google is still very much part of their brand. Here's the part that surprised the heck out of me, and why this lawsuit is being pursued. As part of the settlement, the plaintiffs assert, Google agreed not to make any material modification to its then current offering, this was in 2008, of search engine related products or services in a manner that would likely create confusion with Stelor's, that's the plaintiff, children's related multimedia business, including, for example, by creating, designing, or publishing products that provide fictional children's related content. This is what they're arguing in the complaint and why they're suing, that Google has now reneged on this promise that it made in the original 2008 settlement. And the way in which it has reneged is by, among other things, operating Google Play, which is the app store full of games and music and apps and stories for kids, and also YouTube Kids, which is more of the same programming for kids. What I find stunning is that back in 2008, if they're able to actually establish that this was a term of the settlement, that Google agreed not to materially modify its then current offering of search engine related products or services in a manner that could possibly create confusion with a children's related multimedia business. What do you think of that, Mike?
It's really a fascinating suit, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, at the end of the day, this, as you say, this really comes down to an unfair competition trademark related type claim. So mm-hmm. the question is will consumers be confused? At least as I understand the nature of the claims here, will consumers be confused into thinking that there's a connection between Google's from Goo and Google as a result of Google Play and all the content associated within it. So, I mean, on its face, if these allegations are true, if what's been alleged is accurate, it sounds like a plausible argument to be sure.
Mm-hmm. All right. I expect a blog post in verse on this before too long. So
I'll see what I can do.
Yes, put that on your to-do list. Kyle, any thoughts?
No, it's interesting. I guess in this case, the ordinary consumer might be the consumers of Google's of Goo, so the children who might be perusing the Google Play Store, I guess. I don't know. It'd be interesting to see them analyze what the ordinary five-year-old might think when downloading apps.
Yeah.
It's interesting. Go ahead. Kyle, in that this would, I would presume, be what we call a reverse confusion case, which is different than the typical type of trademark case. It's called a reverse confusion because here the more junior user, which would be Google, the argument is, look, people will potentially and mistakenly believe that Google's from Goo is somehow associated or trying to piggyback on the goodwill of Google, because Google is obviously the behemoth here, and so it raises that potential issue for Google's from Goo to have to contend with. Will consumers really think that Google from Goo is somehow piggybacking on Google's goodwill? So it's a little bit different situation.
Yeah, one of the things the plaintiff alleges in their complaint is that by altering its business practices in a way that the plaintiff says is counter to their settlement with Google, Google has severely damaged Stelor's business. Investors and financiers are unwilling to provide capital to Stelor to promote its children's related multimedia content. Business under the name Google's because they are concerned that Google has already prevented Stelor from progressing with and growing its business. So the fact that they happened to have this name before the behemoth, as you say, Mike, Google came along, is now making people take a hands-off approach to their company because they can't get their heads around the fact that this company isn't somehow running afoul of Google's trademark.
Yeah. So, I mean, if that's true, these are just allegations, but if right. that's true, that is a potential viable claim for reverse confusion, that I'm being harmed mm-hmm. because my reputation as the senior user is actually being besmirched here because everybody now thinks I'm trying to piggyback or otherwise associate myself with Google when it's not the case at all. So interesting.
Yep. Matt, anything to add?
No, I'm not too familiar with this area. Mike, what's a good example of a successful reverse confusion case that you've seen?
So there was the first time this was ever really litigated to completion was actually not that long ago. It was a Big O Tires case out of the 10th Circuit. There was Big O Tires and I forget the name of the other party, but that was ultimately a successful case. I would say by and large, these can be tough cases. A lot of times people say, well, look, what's the harm here? If people think you're associated with Google, so much the better. Isn't that good for you? I think that sentiment can be held. I think by and large, reverse confusion cases can be difficult to ultimately prevail on for that very reason. How are you being damaged, and is there really widespread significant confusion in the marketplace?
All right. I thought that one would tickle your fancy, Mike. What do we move on to next? We move on to self-driving cars, which we tend to think about as things within the realm of robots and machine learning and AI and all that. So here in California, we are just on the verge of having self-driving cars driving around for testing purposes without any drivers involved, human drivers whatsoever. The first permits for this can be issued as early as April 2nd. You can then, if you are a company testing driverless technology in California, you can test with a safety driver, you can go driverless, and you can also get a permit for deployment. That would be deploying a car without any human being behind the wheel whatsoever. So, it'll be interesting here in California to see, how that goes. Right now we have, 1,000 safety drivers licensed to test, autonomous vehicles. These rules would render the safety driver irrelevant. You could have cars out there without any human behind the wheel. Not from a consumer, this is how I'm going to get to work standpoint, but for the companies who are developing these technologies to test them on the open road. So anybody else nervous about this, Mike?
Yes, I'm a little bit nervous, but excited nonetheless. Yeah.
Yes. The other interesting twist to this is, of course, the federal government wants to be able to regulate in this area, and it is possible that they would enact laws that would preempt things that states like California are doing. But so far, things seem to be stalled at the federal level. So it's not surprising to see California and potentially other states moving ahead and making sure that these technologies are tested and ultimately sold to the public. We had in the rundown last week, I believe it was, and I'm sticking it back in this week because we never got around to it, a really interesting piece in the Journal of Law and Technology from North Carolina, known as Jolt. Old blogger friend of mine, Rick Clow, who's now with Google Ventures, is one of the founders of this journal, by the way, and is quite proud of the good work it does. There is a piece published there on how we're going to play out, how the liabilities are going to fall once self-driving cars are in people's hands and on the roads, et cetera, et cetera. And it's a really interesting piece that goes back to horse liability law, because both horses and self-driving cars make decisions on their own and may misinterpret the signals that they're getting from the environment. And there's actually a body of law that developed, you know, when horses were commonly on the roads that dealt with who's responsible when someone's horse runs amok and does damage. So we could see some throwing back to these rather creaky old decisions on horse liability law in the near future. So keep an eye out for that. Matt, any thoughts?
Yeah, I just think that this is really fun and really interesting. It'd be great to, you know, see horse law make its way back. I'm not sure if it's exactly right. I think that the liability is ultimately going to fall on the owners of the company, because I think we've moved on from, I mean, so back in the 16th century, we used to sue sticks for falling on people and killing them. You wouldn't sue the, you know, you wouldn't sue the, you know, you literally sue the tree or like, so like, you know, I don't think we're going back there. So I think that we're going to sue Google or Waymo or Alphabet or however they want to call themselves. And I think that the law is going to go to where the money is, because it ultimately is the best situation for a concept of equity, which I think is fair and good. But if we get some horse law in there, I'm all for it. If any way that Seabiscuit can be mentioned in a brief, I'm a fan.
We're charging out of the gate with the horse law.
Yeah.
Kyle, what do you think?
Yeah, I think the article is really interesting. I think it has some interesting lessons as we go forward with the automated driving technology. I think there are two kind of hangups that I have with applying those types of cases to determine liability in this case. Basically, the idea of the horse law is that, you know, when the disruptive technology that was cars came along, it was incumbent upon the drivers of the cars to be more anticipatory and aware of the nature of the horses as they navigate the roads. But here, I mean, the disruptive technology is the automatic cars. And so to say that it's incumbent upon the people in the regular cars to anticipate the disruptive technology, I think is a little backwards, especially when there's bad drivers. And if you apply the ordinary person standard to the general population, there's going to be people who are just chronically terribly at driving and like basically strictly liable for their activity. And so then to thrust upon them the need to be anticipating, kind of, you know, not doing behavior that might tweak the algorithms of an automatic car, I think is a bit far. And then also, just as a practical matter, if a human can anticipate a driverless car, then I don't think that driverless car is ready for prime time. If there's something I can do, if I see a driverless car and I say, oh, I shouldn't do this one thing because it might mess up the driverless car, if I can predict that, then that driverless car shouldn't be on the road.
Yeah, that's a really good point. Mike, any thoughts?
Well, yeah, I think Mr. Ed would just be thrilled with this discussion.
You would indeed. We'll put him behind
the wheel. Mr. Seussian verse 2?
My wheels are already turning in that direction.
All right. Are wheels the right word, or is it your hooves?
Is it a driverless car if Mr. Ed is driving?
Oh boy. Jeez.
He's not a human. We're getting philosophical here.
That's quite an existential question. Yes.
Yes. All right. I don't know how we don't make reining in the horse law our second MCLE passphrase for this episode of This Week in Law. Now we have both phrases in there, and we're going to move on to close out the show with a discussion of some developments on the front of legislation and policy. All right, in the game of FCC net neutrality three-dimensional chess, the next move was played by the FCC, or I don't know if you'd say it's been played. It's just sort of the wheels of government turning. The net neutrality vote, the FCC's, what is it, Preserving Freedom, Internet Freedom Act, whatever it's calling it. It's been published in the Federal Register, and that is the government's official record of all administrative actions. And this is important because that event triggers what can happen next as far as challenging that the publication of that vote and the impact of it. So it really, really, I mean, I can't stress enough how much this is a chess game, what's going on with the FCC and net neutrality. And there are some really good pieces in the Washington Post that we have in our discussion points. One of them discusses what happens next procedurally now that this event has happened. And one of those things is kind of how we got into this whole mess in the first place. It is a resolution under the Congressional Review Act. That's how the 2015 Open Internet Order was undone, by the way. Many senators want us to have another one of those, which would undo this order. They have 50 votes, including all the Democratic senators. They have one Republican, Senator Susan Collins of Maine. If they got just one more vote, they could pass yet another Congressional Review Act. Do you remember when I showed the actual thing that looked like parchment on the show? It's one of those. And that would have the impact of undoing this order the way the other order was undone. Of course, in this instance, before that Congressional Review Act becomes effective, it has to be signed off by the president. Of course, President Trump was happy to sign off on the one that undid the 2015 Open Internet Order, will not be so happy to endorse this one. In fact, he will undoubtedly veto it. But the way in which this is a chess game is more further described in another Washington Post piece that we also have in the discussion points that describes the quote-unquote motley crew of tech wonks and legal experts meeting in Washington each week to decide what's going to happen next and what the strategy is. And this piece really lays out how, yeah, we know that if we manage to pull off a Congressional Review Act, getting that passed, we know it's going to be vetoed, but the point in doing it is to make people, the senators and others in Washington, take a stand on net neutrality, really put their cards on the table where they are, because it's such a hot button issue and they want people to have to say where they are because they think it's going to be crucial in the midterm elections come this fall. So that's part of how the chess game is playing out. The other part has to do with what the states are doing. We've talked a bit about that on the show. We talked, I think, a couple episodes ago about California. Washington State has now become the first to pass its own net neutrality protections. That just went into effect Tuesday of this week. Mike, what's the scuttlebutt up there in your state about having done this?
You know, I haven't heard a whole lot of buzz about this. Mm-hmm. You know, I think people are still trying to digest it. It's certainly an issue. My kids are even familiar with it. And so it's discussed amongst kids. So it's obviously an issue that's important to a lot of folks. But the thing that caught, I think, most people's attention this past week when it comes to Washington and politics and laws is how Jay Inslee, our governor, was very direct with President Trump during a governor's meeting about all sorts of things, including guns. Mm-hmm. When Governor Inslee, you know, called out President Trump and suggested that he, you know, do more thinking and less tweeting, that mm-hmm. caught a lot of people's attention here, as you can imagine.
Yeah, definitely. So with the publication of the order, we will also see the whole scramble for lawsuits being filed And then there is a lottery as to which jurisdiction will wind up presiding over those lawsuits. So that's all about to ensue in the next couple of weeks. So stay tuned and watch and see how those chess pieces fall. Also, you know, of course, stay tuned as the states continue to enact their own provisions that are designed to replace the 2015 open internet order that was undone, and how they fare, because of course the FCC has taken the stand that no, states, you may not do that. Federal preemption is a thing, and we actually have exclusive authority to regulate in this area. And speaking of FCC authority, one of these Washington Post pieces, it's the one about the Motley Crue meeting and strategizing. It's discussing the fact that there is some impetus in Congress to horse trade a bit with the FCC, and if Congress is going to act to reach some kind of compromise where net neutrality is reinstated, but to appease many who thought that the way it got implemented last time was flawed, had to do with granting the FCC authority under Title II to regulate utilities, that Congress is contemplating how they would grant the FCC its own independent authority rather than scrambling for authority under other provisions of law in order to regulate net neutrality. So that's something also apparently in the mix and being thought of as congresspeople and senators try and put together the way forward here. All really interesting, all really complicated. And again, all so in flux that I really don't think that we're going to see any sort of big moves by the telecom industry to exploit what the FCC has done until the dust has settled more here and there's more stability as to how things are going to look in the future. Do you agree, Matt?
Yeah, I agree that if you're a telecom, it seems like it would be a bad idea to stick your head out and say, oh, we are the villain that you thought we were as you're prepping for litigation. You mentioned that there's a sort of a lottery in determining who gets jurisdiction. I'm not familiar with how that's decided. Could you elaborate on that, Denise?
Well, the Washington Post piece actually goes into great detail on that. And what happens is there's sort of this race to get your lawsuits filed, and there's forum shopping that happens. At least two of the jurisdictions that are capable of hearing these cases, there's some sort of like, if you've been there before, you can be there again thing at play here. So the second, it's not the second, sorry, it's the Federal Circuit in DC, and not the Federal Circuit. I've said this wrong this three times now. No, two times. Third time is the charm. The DC Circuit in Washington, DC is one of the courts eligible, as is the Ninth Circuit here in California. And so suits will certainly be filed in those two. And then as the rest of the suits come out, they're going to try and consolidate them. So we don't, I guess the desire is not to have a circuit split on multiple cases on the same subject matter. So they consolidate them all in one. And I think the way they get to the one is by lottery. That's what I'm gleaning from what I have read. But there is more in the Washington Post on all of that if you want to get into the legal procedural weeds. One other quick story to mention at the bottom of the show here, and that is Axios did a poll. I don't think this will surprise anyone, but I think it does underscore that tech companies are going to have to get on this and get on this fast. And I think net neutrality plays into this too. Axios did a poll where they asked people sort of about their comfort level with technology companies and their conduct and whether they think the companies are doing enough to self-regulate and whether government is doing enough to rein them in. And there's been a huge sea change in opinion. This is not the first time they've conducted this poll. Americans, what they're coming away with, are concerned that government isn't doing enough to regulate the conduct of technology companies. So, you know, to the extent that we're talking about Congress getting anything done and getting pressure from their constituents in the midterm elections coming up, and these hot button issues for young voters in particular, this one is bubbling to the fore. So whereas lawmakers might, because they've got a lot on their minds right now, be inclined to take a hands-off approach if they weren't getting pressured by their constituents, I think they're going to start getting pressured by their constituents to deal with things more proactively, like the fact that social media is so readily gamed by bots and foreign governments, or bots employed by foreign governments, like the way that they manage user data. You know, nobody's forgotten about Equifax, et cetera. So I think this poll is just interesting, and in that unless tech companies really get out in front of this fast and effectively, they're going to find themselves the subject of more regulation and legislation. And as we all know here on This Week in Law, that doesn't always go the best way. that lawmakers try really hard to understand these issues, but sometimes they just whiff on them and don't foresee all the ramifications of their actions. And we wind up with a big mess on our hands. So just wanted to toss that out there, that there seems to be a trend toward Americans wanting government to do more. Oh, and in California, that we're actually, there are two ballot measures that are sort of evidence of this. Representative Mark Levine, a Democrat out of District 10 in California, has two things that are propositions that can be, they'll go on the ballot and they can become law. One of them requires regulation of bots and steps to be taken to prevent the spread of misinformation. And the other one puts users more control of their data and would create a California Data Protection Authority to oversee Californians' personal data on the internet. So if the federal government isn't going to do it, again, you know, the states are going to jump in and try and be responsive to constituents' concerns. Mike, any thoughts?
No, nothing further. I think it's interesting, though.
Yeah. How about you, Matt?
No, I think this will be something good to follow.
Yep. We'll keep an eye on it. Kyle, anything to add?
Yeah, I think it's pretty interesting. I mean, I think part of this is brought about by the lock-in effects that the social networks experience. There's an argument out there. There's a New York Times Magazine article about the potential for blockchain to kind of disrupt the second layer of the internet and maybe lead to a more portable social network. So not directly related to this public dissatisfaction and wanting more regulation, but it'd be interesting to see if down the line, if there was this type of disruptive technology that blockchain could bring about to the social networks, it might lead to more people being able to vote with their memberships to different social networks if there was one that was deciding to regulate the advertising in a different way. And I'd be remiss if we didn't mention blockchain. So,
yeah, you would be remiss. Put it all on the blockchain.
Woody!
Here we go.
All right. Yes, thank you for that. That's a fascinating thought. Let us move on to conclude the show. We have a couple of resources of the week for you. One of them, Emery Roan sent in, actually, to let me know that following up on our discussion about dog rates and the Ellen show, that NPR actually was considering the whole language, the internet language built around love for the puppers back in April of last year. So if you are interested in the origins and derivations of a blem, a blep, a blop, and a bork, and a boof. And what's the difference between a pupper and a pupperino? Do check out this piece from NPR, Dogs or Doggos, an internet language built around love for the puppers. I kind of loved that piece. And also following up on our discussion of Let's Play videos, there is a legal guide out there if you are someone engaged in that burgeoning part of the web. It is put out by gamerlaw.co.uk, and it's a legal guide to Let's Play and gaming videos, which kind of goes through all of the considerations that you might want to think about. I'm afraid it's not terribly practically helpful, because what it winds up coming down to tell you to do is to try and license things as much as you can. And that might be easy in some instances if we're talking about the game developers themselves going to them. It might not be so easy if you're going to the rights holders for other aspects of content that is that are in your Let's Play video. Did you get a chance to take a look at this, Kyle?
I did a little bit, yeah.
Do you think it's done a good job here?
Yeah, it does. It goes through a lot of it. I mean, I think at the moment, what you have to do is basically just get permission. I mean, if the publisher wants to issue a DMCA takedown, they do have a copyright over all the audio visuals. So yeah, currently, users contract away the ability to make fair uses of the work in a lot of the terms of services. So there is some examples in that article where publishers explicitly give people the right to, but I know Riot Games terms of use does basically say that you have to give permission from them if you want to, or they reserve the right to prevent you from doing certain things.
Right. And what I love too is there is a TLDR summary of the law and gaming videos at the end with 7 bullet points that really kind of lays things out for you if you don't want to read the whole thing. So maybe you should have put that at the top, but it's nice that it's there. All right, our tip of the week, hearkening back to the FCC and our discussion thereof, this doesn't have a direct impact on net neutrality, but the FCC has a series of maps relating to broadband employment, deployment. There we go. You can see one on the screen if you are watching the video. And it purports to be able to tell you, if you put in your address, it will find you. It will find your latitude and longitudinal coordinates. And then it will tell you, as you can see over there on the right, all of your options for broadband internet. Well, that's what it says that it does. Our tip of the week is that the map kind of sucks because it will tell you that you have options for broadband internet that you might not consider broadband and or internet. as John Gasparini pointed out in a tweet, in his particular instance, it showed 6 providers for his home at 25x3 speeds or better, but 4 of the 6 are actually worse speeds, et cetera. So, I mean, everyone who's tried this out has said, yeah, well, satellite really shouldn't count. And so take the FCC's map of broadband providers with a grain of salt, I guess would be our tip. And then our animal selfie of the week is, I believe, our first reptile. Thank you, Tim Chase, who is at Gumnos, GUMNOS on Twitter, for sending in this bit from David Attenborough, which has the caption, I don't have it up in front of me, but I think it says, and then he realized the camera was on. And we have a chameleon giving us a lovely look. Now, our family owns a chameleon, and And I can tell you that when a chameleon is looking at you like that, that chameleon thinks you are food. That tongue is one of the fastest things in the natural world. I believe chameleon strikes with their tongues have been clocked at faster than a cheetah can run. So when one is sticking its tongue out at you like that, if you're a bug or a cricket, you are not long for the world. Let's just hope that we're big enough to survive the onslaught here. But thank you very much, Tim Chase. We love the chameleon selfie. And with that, we're going to wrap up this episode of This Week in Law. It has been a great pleasure to get to know you, Kyle. Thank you so much for writing in and for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having me. I really, really enjoyed being here. Thank you.
Anything you want to let our listeners know about before you sign off today? Anything going on with you that you'd like to plug?
I mean, my paper will be out later this month, I think, on the Fordham IPLJ. So if you Google Fordham IPLJ, eventually later this month, book 2 will be out, and you can find my paper on Let's Play, a walkthrough of quarter-century-old copyright precedent as applied to modern video games. So it should be an interesting read, I hope.
That's great. Is it all wrapped up? Are you still authoring?
Yeah. No, it's in the final stages of publication. I'm just waiting on a few final steps from their editing staff. So,
very good. Well, let us know when it's out, and we will let people know, because it's a fascinating topic and very timely and topical for anybody hoping to make a living online via video game streaming or esports or all of the above. So, great chatting with you today, Kyle. We hope to do so again sometime.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you.
Mike Keyes, great to have you back.
It was just a delight to be with all of you today. Thank you so much, and I hope everybody has a great weekend.
Yes, I believe we have lost Matt Curtis, but he is in our hearts and minds. And Matt, we thank you so much for joining us too. It's been a great show. Really appreciate all of your insights and contributions. And we really appreciate the fact that all of you watching or listening have joined us today. If you've done so on Friday, then you've done so at 11 o'clock Pacific time, 1800 UTC. That is when we record the show. We are happy if you can join us live, but don't feel like that is mandatory. It is not. If you head over to twit.tv/twill, our whole archive of shows is there, going way, way back to October 2006. You can find in that archive references to lots of the things we discussed on the show today. So it's kind of fun to see how the law has developed over time, or how trouble areas of the law remain trouble areas over time as the courts and our lawmakers try and grapple with these issues of technology butting heads with the way our laws have been drafted, or maybe haven't been drafted to accommodate the situations that we confront every single day. What else should you do? You should get in touch with us between the shows. You can find us on Twitter. I'm D Howell there. Mike is J Michael Keyes, and Matt is Law Pint. That's a great way to reach out to us. Let us know, you know, just as you're going through your feeds and looking at things during the day, just copy us on whatever you think we might be interested in. Same thing on Facebook. We have a page there for This Week in Law where you can post yourself, or, you know, just shout out to us there, send us a message, or you can send us emails. I'm Denise at twit.tv. Mike is Mike at twit.tv. And Matt is Matt C at twit.tv. If you're writing interesting papers on topics, let us know. If you have feedback on things that we have talked about on today's show or other recent shows, definitely reach out to us. Give us your thoughts and permutations on the discussion. We love to hear them. Always hoping to improve our knowledge and understanding and insights on all of these complicated issues. We hope that you have enjoyed the show today. We've certainly been glad that you've joined us. Do want to give a couple of plugs to some TWIT-related stuff before we sign off today. We are still doing that TWIT survey. If you head over to twit.tv/survey, we would love to hear from you. You can weigh in on our show, all the rest of the shows on the network. We love to hear what's working, what's not for you. So please do give us your feedback. And also, if you are an Amazon Echo device user, Can't recommend enough. I definitely make it part of my morning every day. The Twit Flash Briefing, which is now available in Canada and Australia, the United Kingdom, and India. It's been in the U.S. for some time. So if you have, if you're in any of those places and haven't been listening, please check it out. It's a perfect time now to go into your Alexa app settings, and under Flash Briefing, you're going to look for Twit and just add us to your Flash Briefing rotation. It's a great way to keep up on current interesting events in the technology arena. So with that, we'll go ahead and sign off. Thank you so much to my wonderful panel for being here today, and to all of you for joining us. Until next time, take care.